Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan US Center's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. In May 2024, I spoke to Jeff Legro, university professor at the University of Richmond and visiting professor at the Phelan US Center for 2023-24. A specialist on international affairs, Jeff Legro is the author of numerous books and articles, including Rethinking the World, Great Power Strategies and International Order. He co-edited Shape of Nations, Strategies for a Changing World and Uncertain Times, American Foreign Policy After the Berlin Wall and 9/11. We spoke about the US's role as a unipolar country in the world, conceptions of sovereignty, both in the US and abroad, the potential future of US foreign policy, and the relationship between nuclear weapons and globalization. Thank you so much for joining us in the Ballpark today. It's great to be able to speak to you. Can you just start out by introducing for our audience and giving an overview of your research and work? Thank you.
Sure. I've focused my work on generally in the international relations and in the realm of security affairs. And I tend to look at major powers, issues of grand strategy, military strategy, and often in a comparative context, I'm interested in how different countries react to the circumstances that exist in the world, and of course, how they relate to one another. So that's kind of what I've been focused on mainly.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So the United States is considered by many as unipolar. That is, it's the most powerful country in the world that has little global competition. In the past, you've written that unipolarity is an overvalued concept. Can you talk a bit about what you mean by this, and do you still feel this way?
Sure. I mean, I guess it's easier to say today that it's overvalued because it seems to be waning. But the U.S. is still the dominant power in the world, and it's still important to pay attention to relative power. By power, of course, scholars mean their material and technological capacity. And I think if you look at power and unipolarity seriously, it comes with certain expectations, and scholars have written that the biggest consequence of unipolarity is that states would overextend themselves. You would expect that a unipole, that states would react to it, would balance together to offset the power of the unipole, and you would expect that the unipole would get what it wants. And in fact, we don't and haven't seen any of those things, even right after the Cold War when the U.S. was most dominant. You would expect the U.S. to go out and shape the world, maybe create a new empire, but it did not do that. You would expect other states would have rallied together. NATO might have fallen apart, and states would have, Europe would have said, hold it. You know, we need to be wary of the U.S. if its power is the only thing that matters. And yet, NATO did not do that. And of course, the U.S. has not gotten what it's wanted exactly in international relations, which isn't to say it doesn't get some of what it wants. But what you saw was when scholars tried to explain these things, they relied on factors like intentions. Well, the U.S. is benevolent, and therefore states didn't balance against it. That may be the case, but that's not power. That is something having to do with U.S. intentions. It's domestic traits. Perhaps its democracy is less threatening. That the U.S. did not, go out and conquer the world may have also was not a consequence of power because the world was there, right? But it may have been more a consequence of the U.S. Constitution and identity itself. That's not how it saw itself. It did not see itself as a militarily, at least, conquering country. And of course, in terms of getting what it wants, scholars found that, geez, a lot of other factors matter too. The U.S. might have had a lot of military power. It might have had a lot of financial power, but maybe it was interdependent like other countries were interdependent in areas of trade. So it couldn't get exactly what it wanted because it needed other countries as well. So my premise in critiquing it was you know, don't reduce unipolarity from your portfolio overall, but maybe you want to reduce how much emphasis you're putting on it. That was kind of the point. And I think generally when you look at international relations, there's this tendency of a whole school of scholars to say, start with power and then, you know, bring in other factors as you need them. And what that does is it biases people's understanding that power is the ultimate factor. It's an important factor, but we have to understand it in the context of other big drivers of international relations, identity, interdependence, those kind of things.
Thank you. Just to kind of follow up on that, I think a lot of people who aren't in the IR world would look at the United States' role in the world in the early 2000s, certainly, and looking at invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, and they might look at that and say, is that not the unipole flexing its muscle, as it were? But are you saying that that's just a small representation of that power?
Exactly. I think it is a manifestation of that power. But consider what could have happened, right? I mean, this is not a country taking over the world. This is a country that is getting mired in foreign conflicts, but also withdrawing relatively quickly. And just not using it for the acquisition of oil, of power. You know, Afghanistan did not offer riches. It was a threat. That's why the U.S. was there.
What does the U.S.'s or U.S. policymakers' conception of sovereignty mean for future relations with competitor countries like China or countries where there's a relationship of mutual animosity, such as with Iran or North Korea?
Yeah, so the U.S. is... notion of sovereignty is a very, I would say, multifaceted and complex and seemingly contradictory. You know, first you have to consider that countries have kind of two sides of sovereignty. They have a view on their own sovereignty, and they have a view on the sovereignty of others. And the views about how you treat sovereignty in those two aspects may not be the same. So, for the United States, at the founding of the country, they were the same. The U.S. was, we don't want others messing with us, and we don't want to get involved with others, because if we get involved with others, they may then come and mess with us, and we're simply too weak to manage those kind of challenges. So they were very much a pro-sovereignty, don't involve with others, and others should not get involved with ourselves, because we're a unique type of country. I think that was the attitude. But that changed over time. The U.S. becomes a more powerful country. It starts to get out in the world. It has its own aspects of empire, Hawaii, the Philippines. Hawaii becomes part of the United States. You know, World War I goes out into the world, make the world safe for democracy. And that deviation, I would say, was one where the U.S. still didn't want people to mess with it, its territory itself, the Monroe Doctrine, so on and so forth, but saw a calling out in the world that the U.S. somehow could not thrive if democracy did not exist elsewhere. The U.S. wouldn't have markets, partners, so on and so forth to get along with. There was, of course, reaction to that. You know, World War I experience was not great. The U.S. withdrew from the world. You know, at that point, its view of sovereignty was, I would say, own sovereignty, always very protective. Other sovereignty, more mixed at that point. Involvement in Latin America, but still don't get involved here. And, you know, the current day is, of course, post-World War II, that notion of needing to be out in the world to protect a world that would allow for democracy to thrive and free markets. So the U.S. has this split image of sovereignty. It is one that, in fact, is still don't mess with the U.S., but the U.S. might mess with you, right? So there is a certain level of hypocrisy there that exists. You know, why does that happen? Well, you know, I mean, the U.S.'s relative power changes over time, and that affects its notion of sovereignty and its strong sense of identity as a democracy, and the notion that the U.S. needs to be out in the world to allow for a democracy that thrives is certainly still prevalent.
So you talked a bit about the sort of isolationism post-World War I prior to the U.S.'s entry into World War II. In recent years, we've seen people like Donald Trump try or seem to push the U.S. back into a bit more of I think what was described as an America first sort of position. Do you think there's any chance of the U.S. moving back into a more isolationist sort of agenda for itself, especially if its power is not what it used to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are seeing that trend, and those have been two strong impulses in the U.S. in U.S. history, that trend to get involved in the world and the trend to withdraw and just protect the city on the hill, as it were. Trump certainly represents it, but I think there have been elements in some of Biden's policies as well. I think it's a bit natural in terms of a reaction to some of the losses and some of the pain that's been incurred with the U.S. playing a kind of global order enforcer supporter role. The costs that were incurred and Iraq, Afghanistan, and having a worldwide military presence. That said, I think there are functional reasons, or I should say constraints and opportunities in the international system that put limits on it. Certainly one is globalization itself. And what we see is countries that cooperate with other countries in trade and technology development are those that lead the international economy and become the most wealthy and powerful. So the U.S. can withdraw, but it would pay a large cost to doing that, and there will be pressure to re-engage to take advantage of those opportunities. A second is, dangers, climate change. Incredibly important. Everyone recognizes it. You can't solve it yourself. You have to be involved with others. So how much can you really withdraw and actually address that? And I think as new generations come along, younger generations are much more sensitive and attuned to this. There will be growing pressure on the U.S. to work with others to do something, and other functional reasons from other countries. They have to do it if they're going to sustain their welfare. So that's another reason. A third reason is mutual assured destruction. We're in a world where countries are interconnected by their ability to devastate one another. It's hard to withdraw when that is there, because you need to keep talking and engaged.
Thank you. So you conclude the 2016 book, Shaper Nations, by writing that scholars have paid less attention to rising countries. What are some of these countries, and how are they likely to interact with the U.S. in the coming decades?
So in Shaper Nations, we were looking at, I wouldn't say just rising countries, but countries most likely to shape the future of international politics. And we tried to pick a representative sample. It wasn't comprehensive, but a representative sample of countries that were going to fundamentally shape their regions and likely have an impact on the overall international order. And, you know, it's an important set of countries, because what we recognize is that in a world where power is becoming more distributed, the U.S. relative power is diminishing, China has risen, the EU is quite powerful today, and the set of middle powers, are doing more, and they play a key pivotal role. And we're certainly seeing that today, as we get a little bit of splits into two blocks, the U.S., Europe, Japan, Australia, and you have on the other side maybe China, Russia, you know, Iran, North Korea. These other countries are playing a kind of middle role there. And there are countries like Israel, Turkey, Brazil. And so we were looking at those countries. We were looking at India certainly. We were looking also at countries like Germany, which haven't really totally fulfilled their political place in the world in kind of equal measure to their capacity, as you would say. And of course, China and the US as well as key countries. And so we were trying to look at their strategies and say, you know, what are the strategies of these countries? Is there anything we can say about them that will tell us about the world? And as a group, a kind of set of traits showed up. And one was that we're moving into a more uncertain world because some of these enduring structures are changing. And a good part of that uncertain world is that the identities of these countries are in flux, that there is a kind of fundamental fight over who or what they're going to be in the world. And with that fight unresolved, it's hard to say exactly what direction they're going in their foreign policy. So, for example, Israel. Is Israel a democracy or is it a Jewish state? How is it going to resolve that? India, right? With Modi, you know, is it going to be a religious state? Is it going to be a secular state? And how will that affect what they do? China, the Communist Party, is it a capitalist developing country or is it a Leninist Communist Party? Now that one's become a little bit clearer, at least under Xi Jinping. But Germany, right? What would Germany be in this new structure, right? It hasn't claimed an identity outside of defeated power. And, you know, similar arguments in Brazil, and you could argue that even in the US that debate is going on. And so these internal debates over identity are going to be quite important. But in the meantime, on how they're resolved, they generate a lot of uncertainty about what that country's going to do. Is it going to switch? Is it going to stick with it? What are its ambitions ultimately going to be? So that was one thing. Another thing had to do with the notion that international order would be tough to make progress on, that collective goods at the global level would probably be underprovided. Why? Because a lot of these countries are singularly focused on economic development. And they're focused on their region, right? To the extent they care about order, it's in their region. So when you're focused on development, you don't have a lot of extra to give to climate change, right? Where you're going to make sacrifices is going to be on some of these global goods. Or you don't want to spend a lot of time on political capital, on international norms. You want to control your region. So, you know, this is what the Brazils, Israels, you know, Turkeys, Indias, arguably China, and arguably Russia, although Russia is like right over the line into Europe. So that's why it affects things. And the third thing we kind of found, again, this is in 2015, was that for the immediate future, the world would be relatively peaceful because these countries were singularly focused on economic development, right? And making progress there. But that in situations where those economic goals weren't being met, conflict was a real possibility and danger. And even in 2015, we said, you know, the one country that's an exception to this is Russia, you know, because Putin is not trying to build power through economic development. He's building it through geopolitical presence and status. So that was a red flag to us at that time. And of course, their economic project has not been going well, which of course reinforces that tendency to build it geopolitically and status-wise. So that was the marker we were looking at. And unfortunately, it has bore out that Russia was the more conflict-prone. But we need to keep an eye on some of these other countries. And China is a concern in this regard, a country that has built its legitimacy based on sovereignty, but also based on its economic record. When that economic record is flailing, there may be incentives to try and bolster CCP legitimacy through physical expansion.
Is the US doing anything to help shape those countries as they change and develop to influence the world order, to make it maybe more friendly for itself as they change and develop?
Yeah. Well, certainly the US is out there trying to shape a world order that serves its interests. And, I think, those efforts sometimes work and sometimes they don't. Nations have interests that conflict, but in the UN and various trade agreements, consistently they've been trying to shape a world around China, for example, that says, hey, physical expansion, trying to resolve Taiwan by force, trying to intimidate and coerce the countries around you by force is not acceptable. And therefore, we see the expansion of the South China Sea and we're going to react to that. So we're going to build stronger allied ties around you. We're going to have Marines doing military exercises in the Philippines that prepare for those types of circumstances. We're going to build a different relationship with India, which is also worried about your expansion. China sees encirclement, right? The U.S. sees, hey, we're simply saying, these kind of things don't serve our interests and we're going to react to them. Let's find another way to do this. So it's a tricky situation, I think, in Asia right now, because both sides see themselves a little bit aggrieved. Both are trying to maximize what they want. But there are two incentives that bring them that are, I think, going to continue to bring them back. One is basically globalization, that China needs to be engaged and the U.S. needs to be engaged if they're really going to thrive to their potential economically. And for China, that's been traditionally very important. They cannot make their way to the top of the technology ladder by themselves. They need to have partnerships. And the U.S. does as well. And then the other one, of course, is, you're dealing with mutual assured destruction. So they have to keep talking to each other to avoid getting into a conflict that's going to result in mutual annihilation. And of course, the third big incentive today is climate change. And they recognize that these two countries are quite critical to that. And that's going to keep them working on it.
So you're a longstanding expert on U.S. foreign policy. Depending on who occupies the White House on January 21st, 2025, U.S. foreign policy may remain as it has been largely over the last 3 years, or it may shift dramatically. How might Donald Trump's foreign policy differ in his second term from Joe Biden's and from Trump's first term?
Well, in terms of Biden v. Trump, there are a couple distinctive differences. I would think the two biggest differences are attitude towards alliances and attitude towards other populist regimes. And a Trump presidency, I think, would be a fundamental turning point in how the United States is perceived on both those scores. So alliances, of course, pushing NATO, pushing our East Asian allies is, of course, standard practice for the United States, to pushing them to give more contributions to how the alliance works. I personally think some of those contributions are not well understood, and the burden of hosting troops and cost of that is not always factored in as it should be. But Trump could really put pressure on those relationships that lead them to change. Europe could develop a much more autonomous policy from the United States, not necessarily in the U.S. interest. It could lead to more fracturing within Europe that makes it harder to deal in a unified way with Russia. Obviously, I think you're going to get more sympathy towards some of the more autocratic leaders and, the Putins, the Orbans. And what you can see in a Donald Trump is not as much concern for the notion that the welfare of U.S. democracy depends on democracy elsewhere. I just doesn't seem to believe that. And, you know, some believe that maybe President Trump doesn't really care about the quality of democracy in this country as well. He's a person very much focused on economics, although it's not clear, you know, is the goal to maximize U.S. economic growth? Is it to, you know, help certain sectors of society? Those questions are unanswered. So I think that's where you'll get the biggest changes is alliances, populist regimes, and, you know, obviously in style. He's a transactional leader. He looks for the big deal. He is maybe more aggressive on tariffs, I think you'll see. There's a trend in the U.S. towards using tariffs. This is by Biden as well, a reaction to our globalization record and those sectors of the economy and society that were left behind. Both parties have turned to tariffs to address that. But Trump in a much larger way and trying to make a case for the overall economy, which is, at least in my mind, not plausible. But former Prime Minister Abe of Japan said about Trump, he thinks about diplomacy and security through an economic lens. And I think that's right. It's like everything's kind of economic and everything's transactional. So there'll be a difference in that regard as well. And, you know, Biden also has shown, you know, some of the tendencies to push our allies to contribute more, you know, possibly using tariffs and government policy to further the country's economic welfare. But he does it in a different way. It's a different style. And fundamentally, he, you know, believes in alliances, the importance of those alliances for how the world works. And that's just not the case for President Trump, or doesn't seem to be. Now, how Trump is different from his first term is a great question. You know, I think he comes in with more experience. So he's going to have a team that's more experienced. Maybe he'll be more effective at what he wants to get. You know, on the one hand, it's a contradictory position, because on the one hand, there are fewer restraints on him kind of seeking private goods, right? And maybe revenge. You know, a lot of people have brought up, you know, he might revenge against political opponents. On the other hand, he's also got the constraint of being a lame duck president. And even if he gets elected, he's likely to face one, if not both houses of the opposite party, the Democrats, being in control. So he's not going to be able to call all the shots. And in some ways, there may be more skepticism about what he's doing. But if he were president, the power of the president is significant. And there's a lot he can do through executive action. So it will be a very lively time in U.S. politics, for better or for worse.
Thank you. So during your time with the U.S. Center here, you've been working on a research project which looks at whether nuclear weapons increase economic interdependence and cooperation. Can you give our listeners a brief outline of this work and your findings so far?
Sure. So most of the work on nuclear weapons and their impact has focused on military strategy, crises, likelihood of peace. Really important work, great work. And it just occurred to me that we haven't thought enough about the impact of nuclear weapons on issues beyond security affairs. For example, economic interdependence, globalization, international institutions. And yet there are good reasons to think there may be a link, because what nuclear weapons, called the absolute weapon, and when they were first developed, scholars wrote about them and they said, wow, these are going to have a really dramatic effect on international relations because they're going to impact anarchy. The notion that without a world government, you're always vulnerable to physical attack. Well, nuclear weapons, if you have a secure second strike capability, make a calculated attack on your country, the ability to take you over, enslave you, impose a different form of government very difficult. So the impact of that is you have more assurance that you can operate in the world and not be vulnerable. Now, one of the constraints, traditional constraints, for example, on expansive trade deals is the other side may gain more than me in this trade deal and then turn that gain into capacity to take me over, right? You know, the capitalists will sell the rope that will hang them, right? Lenin, right? And nuclear weapons, however, give you a certain guarantee that even if the other side gains a little bit more, you can't be taken over, right? There are ways to rejigger, recalculate, change your policy, and restore your position, right? And nuclear weapons give you the assurance to take certain kind of risks. So, for example, where normally you might see a military threat and you need to spend money on your soldiers, your conventional arms, nuclear weapons give you the guarantee that, hold it, if we don't do that, we still can't be taken over because we have nuclear weapons. And therefore, that money might be spent doing something else, right? That's, you know, and nuclear weapons, once you get that capacity up and going, are relatively cheap compared to conventional power. So what it should have done, nuclear weapons didn't fundamentally change anarchy. States were still vulnerable to being attacked. But what it did give them is a greater assurance to take risks. And those risks, I think, have fundamentally shaped the world since World War II. So, for example, a couple key instances where nuclear weapons pretty much underwrote what we know as globalization and the level of like international institutions we have. So, first instance is that right after World War II, the U.S. is under significant pressure to bring the troops home, to spend less on defense. Significant fears by Truman and Eisenhower that if you're trying to compete with the Red Army through conventional means, it would fundamentally change the nature of the U.S. state because you would need to keep, you know, extracting resources and have, you know, the government in charge and running industries, you know, which is what happened during World War II. Limit personal freedoms. That happened in the U.S. during World War II, and that we would become the very state that we were trying to fight against. Well, what they realized was that nuclear weapons would allow them to make the commitments to offset the huge conventional superiority the Red Army had in Europe and still bring the boys home, right? And still convert some of those resources into economic well-being and Marshall Plan and so on and so forth, right? So the U.S. made commitments around the world that it would not have been able to sustain in a conventional world. Those commitments and the trade agreements and the relationship that they developed out of them were essentially the framework of globalization. So take away nuclear weapons in that instance, U.S. would have made fundamentally different decisions, and the commitments and interdependence and international institutions that grew up after that would not have occurred in the way they did. Instance number one. Instance number two, 1970s, China. Coming out of the Cultural Revolution, Mao dies. Who's going to take over for Mao? What is China going to do? China's economy is in bad shape. China has a minimal nuclear deterrent. There's a big debate in the 70s with Deng Xiaoping and some of the other Chinese leaders at that time. And Deng basically says, look, here's what we need to do. We need to deprioritize military spending. Military is still one of our four priorities, but it's fourth. And what we need to do is build our economy. And by the way, we can't build our economy without opening up and starting to form partnerships with the United States, for gosh sakes. The United States has intervened in China like 20 times between 1921 and 41, right? I mean, it was very involved there, right? And the opponents to Deng are saying, you know, we can't do that. The imperialists will come in again. They'll take us over. And a key factor in that debate was we have nuclear weapons now. They can't take us over, right? We have something that can answer them if they were trying to invade and dominate us. And so they push off military spending. They open up to join the world. And China's, of course, joining the economy is like the supercharger to, you know, what we've known as globalization, right? That would not have happened in the way it did without nuclear weapons. Third instance, the end of the Cold War, right? Gorbachev is trying to convince the West they're not a threat. So he makes all these concessions in the arms control agreements, nuclear arms control agreements. You know, they get an agreement on weapons in Europe, which, you know, Gorbachev thinks is going to fracture the West, is going to prove to them he isn't hostile, but it gets held up in the U.S. Senate. The U.S. Senate says, hold it. Why do we want to sign an ambitious nuclear arms agreement in Europe? They've got a huge conventional army there, right? They want us to not have nuclear weapons because they've got conventional dominance. We're not going to approve this. Gorbachev has a bigger plan. He realizes he needs to engage the West to get his economy going. He doesn't think the West is going to invade, but he has a guarantee. And this is how he puts off his internal critics. It's like, they've come for us, Napoleon, Hitler, they'll come again, right? And, you know, he and his team say, well, no, you know, we're gonna show them we're not a threat by cutting 500,000 troops in Central Europe, 10 tank divisions and all the equipment and people, and we're just going to withdraw them and we're going to let those states make their own choices. What? You know, we need the buffer. We need this. No, because we've got nuclear weapons. They can't come for us in the same way because we will use nuclear weapons and they know that and it will not happen. So if you think of those three instances, and that, of course, opened the way for the single world economy that kind of, you know, obviously exploded after 1990, for better or for worse, for some good outcomes, some bad outcomes. But you can't tell the story of globalization and the rise of international institutions without understanding what this impact of nuclear weapons was.
Potentially to take your findings, your argument to a logical conclusion, then, is a world without nuclear weapons potentially less safe, less prosperous?
It is, in my view. Okay, now, could we somehow magically get rid of nuclear weapons and erase it from everybody's mind? You know, like that Beatles movie where everyone didn't know what the Beatles were, you know? And just like in that movie, like, this is the problem. Like, the one guy who knew the Beatles could turn it into, you know, an empire if he'd wanted, right? And this is the problem with nuclear weapons. Once we have them, you can't magically get rid of them. So it means that if you tried to go to zero, the country closest to breakout or the country that could build 10 quickly and potentially use them would have strong incentives to do so. That's a more dangerous world, I'm afraid. So at some point, we may come up with a technology that's able to negate the delivery or use of nuclear weapons. Something will happen along those lines. It always has in history, and we'll move on to something else, hopefully something safer. But for the time being, nuclear weapons are part of our landscape, and the aspect of them about mutual assured deterrence is something that has brought a lot of sobriety to international relations. I'm not a fan of nuclear weapons. I'm in favor of their reduction, their control, a lot of talks about how you use them, but we have to exist with them at this point, unfortunately. But I think we could do so with a lot fewer and in a lot more constrained ways. And I think we need to talk a lot more among each other about our procedures and policies and safeguards so that we don't stumble into a really, really terrifying situation. So,
thank you. So, as part of your research project, you've been working with U.S. Center undergraduate research assistants. Can you say a few words about your work with them this year?
Sure. It's been a great joy and pleasure to work with a couple undergrads here at LSE. First of all, the students are terrific, and I had the great good fortune of being able to work with two different students. So one was a terrific undergrad who is a stats major, knows nothing about international relations, but knows a lot about statistics. And we were doing some really interesting work looking at just relationships between countries that acquire nuclear weapons or are afforded the nuclear umbrella. Did that affect their risk profile in terms of the risk they took on international economic agreements or on compromises to sovereignty through joining international institutions? And, you know, these are data that aren't crystal clear to speak to these kind of things because no one's really looked at this before, but there did seem to be a positive association between the number of ambitious agreements states signed and the acquisition of nuclear weapons. So some evidence that suggested this relationship did hold up, and that student did a terrific job on it. The second one is I've been working with an undergrad who is a Singaporean fighter pilot, and he's here getting his undergraduate degree. And we were working on the views of individual leaders towards nuclear weapons, what we called keepers of the button. And did those views change at all? And did those views seem to stay the same, or did they adapt? Now, as you can imagine, if you look at the countries that have had nuclear weapons and their leaders, it's a number of countries. The leaders come from very different backgrounds, very different views, actually, when they entered office on the usability of nuclear weapons, the desirability of use, how you would use them. And some wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons, have a zero-free nuclear world. Others wanted to deploy them, you know, as a normal war-fighting tool, as a means of coercion of other countries. But what you saw is these leaders over time all ended up in the same place. They all ended up in a place where nuclear weapons are only good for protecting your homeland and sovereignty, right? Minimal deterrence. If you hit us, we will hit you. They didn't serve many other purposes in international politics. So this mutual assured destruction is kind of a focal point among leaders, and they become socialized into that through a variety of experience that they have as leaders. But you notice that when someone becomes responsible for making the decision to launch an attack that could kill millions of people and invite, you know, the murder, the slaughter of millions of their own people, their attitude on nuclear weapons changes. They recognize what a burden that is and what these things can really do, because it's hard, at least in what we've seen in the history to this point, to escape the uncertainty that you might be hit, even though they all try to figure out ways to minimize that. You know, they explore plans for first strikes. They look into capabilities, defensive systems. None of them has been able to escape the mad box. And they've essentially realized, okay, this is what they're good for. Don't give me plans for expansive use of these things, because that makes no sense. And we're going to have to do it in a different way. So there's some hope and encouragement from that, but we also have to be concerned about accidents and, you know, situations where there is misunderstandings, that understanding of mutual assured destruction somehow gets pushed to the side in a fantasy of, that use might actually make sense.
Thank you so much. So just before we finish, I'd just like you to give you an opportunity to talk about any projects you're working on, any new books or articles you'd like our audience to know about.
Well, I'm in the process of ginning up my work. I've been coming off a period where I've been acting as a campus leader and administrator in how the university runs, and so this year has been a return to my scholarship And, you know, the work on nuclear weapons and globalization is really the heart of it. And so I'm working on a series of articles on that. And that's really where my focus is right now. Also very, very interested in and working on U.S.-China relations and what is likely to happen there in the future. And, you know, as I mentioned in some of my comments, I really think these two countries have strong incentives to re-engage. That doesn't mean they're going to do that. But over time, you know, you can beat your head against the I'm going it my way. You know, you can enter the I'm going it my way room. You can enter the I'm just going to do a military buildup and ignore what you're doing. But you find out once you get in those rooms that the world may be passing you by and you're letting significant opportunities to improve the welfare of your country, your people, your security pass you. So those are incentives to come back and start talking again and seeing if you can make progress, just like Deng brought up, you know, broke out of the kind of hardcore communist, you know, opposition position to engage. And the U.S. has broken out of its isolationism in the past. I think you will see those incentives kick in over time. And the real trick is in the meantime, not to get in a really horrendous, nasty war, which would be, I think, a tragedy for everyone involved.
Thank you so much. Professor Jeff Legro, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
Pleasure to be here, Chris.
Jeff Legro is University Professor at the University of Richmond and Visiting Professor at the Phelan U.S. Center. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Jeff Legro for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/United-States. On Twitter and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on Facebook and LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This extra inning was produced by Chris Gilson and Anderson Tan. A theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or of the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.